You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
From Shakespeare to Schwartz, from Fosse to Alvin Ailey, from Sondheim to Bareilles, from McNally to Fay, it happened to the greats, it still happens every day.
When lightning strikes,
it's the moment you know.
When lightning strikes,
where you're meant to go. You can stand and shout Eureka, do whatever you like. You'll never forget the moment when lightning strikes.
Hi, this is Gerald Brunner, and you're listening to When Lightning Strikes, where we talk about the tingly mic drop moments that led you to becoming an artist. Bobby Conte currently plays Cousin Kevin in the Who's Tommy on Broadway. Some of his other theater credits include Company, A Bronx Tale, My Fair Lady, A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, Starting Here, Starting Now, and A Comedy of Terrors. Welcome, Bobby.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
It's such a joy to have you on the show. I've loved your work since seeing you in A Bronx Tale and beyond. So can you talk about Tommy when that came into your life? I know you did it in Chicago at the Goodman Theater, but when did you hear about Tommy and the possibility of...
Oh, goodness. Well, I mean, the first time I had heard about Tommy was when I was a teenager, and our one of my local community theaters in Half Moon Bay, California, was doing a summer production of it, and I went and auditioned for it, and I was very luckily cast as Tommy, and I would go home every night to my mom and say, "Oh my God, have you heard of The Who?" And she'd go, "Yes, Bobby, I have heard of The Who." So it's very surreal now to be a continual small part of the legacy and the pantheon of this show and of this IP of this storytelling record that changed the landscape, not only for theater in general, but also for rock. So when I heard about this particular production, I had just finished doing Company on Broadway, and I got an audition and came in and met Dez a couple times, and had to do a dance call for Lauren and her associates, which I hadn't done a dance call in a good number of years, and that was very, very fun and a little terrifying, but galvanizing. And then they very sweetly asked me to come on board, and we went out to Chicago last summer, and now we're here, including really my favorite part of this experience is my favorite part about doing theater in general is the familial nature of what we do. And when you work at the Goodman in Chicago, there's a certain number of non-equity local Chicago hires they have to do, particularly for when they do big musicals, because many times they're doing plays. I think they have multiple spaces. And the vast majority of that Chicago company is here in New York, including those non-equity Chicago locals. So these kids are living in New York City for the first time in their lives. They're getting their equity cards, making their Broadway debuts. And so the familial energy that's in that building every day is an extraordinary thing to be a small part of, and to try to be in any sort of way a leader for those people is my great honor.
That's so extraordinary that you have these people from making their Broadway debut. What a dream come true, working with a dream team of collaborators. So what was it you said? I love the kismet that you first connected with the album and the show that a while back. What was it about the album and the show that really resonated with you? It's such a unique, it's such an experience, you know, both listening to the yes. album and seeing the show.
What's amazing is that when you listen to the album, that 8 minute sort of silent film sequence that's in the show is still on the album. You know, I don't know many other rock albums that begin with an 8 minute almost symphonic orchestra with French horn. Mm-hmm. You know, Pete Townshend was 23, 24 years old when he wrote this and was breaking barriers even then, let alone what the subject matter is about. I was mostly just struck by, which I think is a universal truth in any sort of art, is the more specific you make something, the more it reaches a universal sort of audience. I can't imagine something as weird or odd or idiosyncratic about a kid who becomes deaf, dumb, and blind and becomes a pinball wizard and then becomes an idol that people put on pedestals once they're healed and cured. That's a pretty avant-garde, hyper-specific story, and yet we all feel like we can find a part of ourselves in it, whether you're listening to the original album or whether you've come to the theatrical experience. So I think that's what's stuck with me and what I'll hold most dear long after this experience comes to its end, is being able to trust the weird, hyper-specific, idiosyncratic parts of yourself that you want to share out in the world and know that those can be held no matter how unique it might feel.
I love that nod to specificity. I worked at a magazine. We used to say God is in the details, or actually dog is in the details, because we would have to find out people's dogs mm-hmm. anyway, for the stories.
Oh, goodness.
Anyway, so I know it's hard to scintillize or to describe, or maybe it isn't. For people who might not know Tommy, without giving too much away, because it's you want people to have that experience, but how would you describe the show and your role?
Well, the plot point, the climactic event that sets the events in motion, I guess, perhaps, yeah. is a 4-year-old child sees his father, who he had been told had died in the war, come home out of nowhere, almost like he's seeing a ghost. His mother has found a new lover and is trying to move on with her life. And his father shoots the lover once the lover starts to intervene in an almost sort of domestic violence situation. And in the heat of this extraordinary moment, the parents are terrified and turn to see their 4-year-old child who has witnessed this murder. And in order to not to try to avoid going to jail or having their lives upended, they say to this child, "You didn't hear it, you didn't see it, and you won't say anything." And that turns the child deaf, dumb, and blind. And then we are sort of set off from there. And my character, Cousin Kevin, is the older cousin of Tommy Walker. And ultimately, I think Kevin is just a very curious, bored young man who is living in isolation in his own sense. I think, like every character in the show, is going through their own idiosyncratic versions of trauma and isolation and are looking to connect. And the first thing Des actually told me when we first met about this show was, he said, "I want you to think of Kevin as an artist." That rarely sadists or psychopaths, as Kevin's perhaps been described in other contexts, rarely have the self-awareness that they're psychopathic right. or sadist. So they would see themselves as a person who doesn't know how to contextualize their creativity. And imagine this child is a blank canvas that can't fight back, that can't yell back, and what's great about the song I sing, Cousin Kevin, all of the lyrics are questions or ponderings about what would happen if I do yeah. certain things. So it's almost like a great avant-garde artist, or as a great scientist. He just goes about living with this blank canvas and seeing what happens. And to his bewilderment, as to many others, who knew that the thing that would actually get a reaction from this blank canvas is just putting him in front of a pinball machine. And from that moment, he ends up becoming his great supporter and ultimately his great protector, almost like his lieutenant, as Shakespeare would say. So the arc from going from a childhood bully or sadist, but ultimately just a curious artist, into his right-hand man and someone that he lives his life in service of, is a fascinating, super fun, thrilling journey to go on that I just have a blast doing.
What an arc. And then that's all a backdrop of the Who's music, you know? So, and what...
Yes, to be able to sing.
No, I think about, you know, the repertoire of just, you know, how you were, you know, singing Sondheim and now you're singing The Who. And what is that like for you to sing this rock? I mean, it's the mute, this, the voices are beautiful and there, it, you just think, oh, of course this should be on Broadway. You know, it's, I love how it's, you know, not,
well,
what you might.
I'm glad that it now has that reaction where people feel like, of course, this belongs in the musical theater medium. And I think Pete, in some ways, had always hoped that it would live beyond rock, but I don't think it's a guarantee. So ultimately, I just feel very humbled and honored to be asked in any way to reintroduce this music to generations and people who haven't heard it before and try to put my own stamp on it that's ultimately in service of what Pete and Roger were doing on that original album, which I think many of us in this production are trying to do. We're trying to sing it with a vocal quality and an authenticity that is required to really service this music, which doesn't exist much in the musical theater milieu, especially when you're trying to do something 8 times a week. To be able to sing with a gruff, coarse voice healthily has been a very fun challenge to take on and ultimately very fulfilling. And then to go to, you know, going from what I had just been singing before on Broadway of being able to have the great fortune to sing another 100 people. You know, I don't think I'm alone in that every actor wants to be seen as versatile. Every actor wants to be seen as not being pigeonholed into one thing. And to be given the opportunity by these great directors and really casting directors that have the faith to call me in for things that are radically different from the things I've done before in New York City, I know how lucky I am to be afforded that opportunity. And it's all I hope to do for my career and my life in the theater. If I think many of us want to just run a marathon like life in the theater, you want to just build a breadth of work and work with extraordinary people that are not only your idols growing up, which is certainly what Des was to me and what Pete was to me, but also sort of curate your own community of artists and people that are your age and of your generation that are trying to make things as well. If I can live a varied life in that way, playing things that have no correlation to what I've done before, I would find that to be a very successful but fulfilling, soulful life. And so the fact that I've been afforded that opportunity very early on, I find to be a great luxury and a great privilege.
You've played so many eclectic roles, you know, just the ones I've mentioned, and I know there are many more. What surprised you about Pete? Was there anything, you know, when you got to work with him, he's such an integral part of the show. What was there something that surprised you working with him?
It was a delightful surprise to see how grounded and salt of the earth he is. We were just talking off camera before this began about our partners. And when Des introduced me to him by saying I've been fortunate enough to be coupled up now with my partner Martina, who's an extraordinary playwright and artist in her own right.
Yes.
And you know, his wife is an extraordinary artist as well. And he said the phrase, "Oh, I live in my wife's shadow." And then we chatted for a bit, and he walked away to talk to someone else. And Des said, "Imagine Pete Townsend saying to someone, yes, I live in my wife's shadow," as revolutionary and extraordinary as an artist who has defined a genre of music as he has, to say, "Oh no, but I live in the shadow of my person." That shows the humility that he has. The very generous, kind things he shared with me about where this character of Kevin comes from in his life. Because certainly Tommy is a metaphor, is a very broad, extreme metaphor for many things that Pete has experienced in his own life and was trying to channel and heal from by making this piece of art, which is what I think we're all trying to do when we're making art, to understand where this comes from in his family and my job to sort of honor that in its own way And certainly a way I think I'm trying to do it is through a good deal of humor. He's been very sweet and complimenting me about how a humorous might take, it seems to be, given the sadistic things that I'm saying I'm doing to this child. But I think it's vital so that you as an audience member can not sit there with your arms folded going, yikes, this is intense, but instead be able to lean forward and be intrigued and perhaps laugh so that you're engaged, not only what I'm doing, but in the story that we're all servicing, so that there's not a distance from you and that you don't have your hand up, but instead are leaving your heart open to feel the catharsis that we all want to feel in the theater. So for him to be in support of that and to own who he is, but also extend light and generosity to other people has been a great surprise and something I would hope all of my heroes would be able to
that
embody.
Says so much about him. You're right, his character, and also just the way Cousin Kevin is portrayed through movement is fascinating to me. That's, you know, because of Lauren, your choreographer, Lauren Latour, you know, and how, you know, there's this whole, dare I say, like a vocabulary, you know, that you get from just watching him and the way he operates, which is so fascinating to me.
Yeah, Lauren's really been let loose in this show, which is extraordinary because, yeah, her work is, I feel like in the way that there's a Bob Fosse style and a Jerome Robbins style and Michael Kidd style, I think people can look at this show and her work and be like, this is a Lauren Lataro styling of dancing.
Yes.
It's so idiosyncratic and her, and it's an honor to try to live up to and service and give justice to. And especially since as we're, I don't, maybe what your reference is to is as the show moves into the second act and we play with the notion of time and how, as I become his great protector and his lieutenant, the physicality that's created there versus when I'm just a teenager being a being a fun, creative, sadistic bully to him. There were things that we wanted to subtly layer in that then magnify into a much broader context later on. So finding that the goose steps and the militarized movements that come from a child and then can live into something much bigger was very fun to discover. And I think the one of the first things Des said to me when we met, he's like, wow, you're tall. So we found a way to use my height to the advantage in with that physicality, for sure.
Or just, I mean, I know you're not the one playing pinball, but watching Tommy play pinball in this physical way, it's just fascinating, you know, to see that.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
How he does it. I want to talk about, switching gears, your lightning strikes moment when you knew you had to be an artist. From what I've researched, I learned that you were, what, two or three, that you were in a choir and then started taking voice lessons. I mean, literally a baby or a young kid. So tell me when you kind of knew or had the sense that this was going to be your path.
Oh, goodness. Well, yes, my mom told me I sing around the house a lot. And so she put me in a choir, hoping that it would shut me up, that structure would make me sort of bored from it. But instead, it serviced it more, because no one else in my family are singers or artists. So she sort of didn't know what to do. But what she was ultimately was an incredibly supportive parent that saw a child that had a passion very early on and instilled in us as children that as long as you live a life in service of passion, you'll live a life that's ultimately fulfilling. So I think the first show I did when I was, you know, again, a child, maybe 6 or 7, was The Wizard of Oz at a children's theater that I think maybe at my school I had seen a flyer for, grabbed it off the wall and showed it to my mom. So she went, okay, I'll drive you there. But she never helped me learn lines. She never was pushing me to say, hey, what about this theater? What about this show? I came to her with this love and this dream and this hope. And she was saying, of course, I will help service that in any way that you need. But she never had to push me in that way. So I guess you could make the argument that lightning struck as early as 2, or that it didn't strike for many, many years later, because I think I'm sure many of your other guests have said maybe similar things, but it's a different thing when you find a love for something because people around you are saying you're good at it versus a love that's innately a part of you that is as bright and shining even when there is no focus on you and no words of affirmation and no external love being given. And so particularly when you move to the city and you can have very humbling experiences of constant rejection, to find that inner love in the face of so much rejection and so much turmoil is the thing that really can galvanize you and brings you back to why do you love this in the first place? And ultimately for me, even from doing The Wizard of Oz when I was a child, it was the familial nature of the thing. I felt like I found community and a group of friends with a common vocabulary and a desire to support each other and be of service of something bigger than themselves that I had never seen before. And that's what kept having me come back and back and back to it. Beyond even people saying that I was good or I was making an impact in their lives, it was that feeling in the rehearsal room that I loved perhaps even more than performing in front of an audience. And it's what I still love. I love the rehearsal process. I love the tech process. I love going out of town where no one really knows anyone else in a city besides your company, and you need to form that familial nature very quickly and simply as in order to survive for months and months and months in a town that's not yours. So it's what will constantly bring me back. And so that lightning strike moment was the familial nature of it, for sure.
And this was in the Bay Area, right?
Yes, in San Francisco.
And is it true that you started working professionally early? Like, was it Equus or when you were very young, a teen, like 18 years old? Do I have that right? Something around there?
Yeah, I went to a high school in the Haight-Ashbury. And so it was very cool. I've talked about an eclectic place to grow up and learn from. So, but that being said, the school was a very small school. There weren't a ton of guys that were interested in doing theater in my high school. And while we certainly did some cool avant-garde shows, we did a show called Nymph Errant by Cole Porter. Did a play called Bob Rauschenberg America about the great artist Bob Rauschenberger, yeah, who's famous for just having that blank canvas as, yes, a painting. And I think probably the most mainstream thing we did was Urine Town. But otherwise, it forced me to, like, isn't that funny that Urinetown's the most mainstream thing we could have done? But it forced me, for better or for worse, to find communities and theaters outside of my high school in order to service this passion that I had. And there was a great Equity Theater in the Tenderloin, actually, in a pretty sketchy part of San Francisco that was doing Equus, and they were looking for 18-year-old actors to do this part, and I just turned 18, so I was legally able to do it. And my great acting teacher, Craig Slate, formerly of American Conservatory Theater at ACT, recommended me to come and audition, and I got the job. And I remember when I got it, my mom said, you're going to take the weekend and think about this, and we're going to have conversations around the table, and we're going to watch the movie, and so you can really understand, yeah, what you're signing up for. And at the time, Daniel Radcliffe had just done it on Broadway. And so all I sort of knew about it before I auditioned was like, oh, this is the Harry Potter naked horseplay. And I had found an interview he'd done, I don't know with what publication, but basically the interviewer asked him pretty point blankly, are you nervous about getting excited on stage? And Daniel Radcliffe went, no, because then people will think more of me. And I went, That's an awesome answer. That's a way to like offset the fear in your brain that could obviously come with being exposed to a group of strangers every night. let alone the fact that what's more important is that in the context of play, when he's trying to have this intimate moment with this girl in the stable, he is unable to get excited, quote unquote, because he's seeing the face of his god, of this horse, in her eyes, and he can't get it out of his head, which then leads him to blind these six horses with a metal spike. So once I was able to offset the fear and the real reality that that's what I was going to be doing every night, it just became about giving over to this extraordinary piece of writing and sort of for the first time in my life, becoming like a great detective in how you do text analysis and create a community with real professional actors, which I had never had the opportunity to do with before. And to feel like it was my first step in as a professional, as someone who was coming in and showing that they were prepared and were coming in with a head full of ideas, but also open to spontaneity and open to other people's instincts, and feeling like I had a safe place to explore all that, gave me the confidence to go and apply for different theater programs across the country. And I ended up writing my college application about the process of taking on that job. So I'm very grateful for that period of time in my life. And I'm sure that's a very unique way of coming into the theater. I don't think many people get the opportunity to play Alan String at 18 years old.
Baptism by fire, which then you went to Michigan, right? University of Michigan. Do I have that right? That you went there?
Yes, University of Michigan. Yeah.
And then,
go blue, baby.
So here's, and then you end up in New York, and I'm thinking about these incredible collaborators you've had. I mean, I think about, A Bronx Tale, right? You made your Broadway debut, right? Was in A Bronx Tale, Robert De Niro, Jerry Zaks, co-directing, Chaz Palminteri, beloved Nick Cordero. What was that? That was your Broadway debut. Gosh.
Yeah, it was very, very, very surreal. And, ultimately, just the greatest learning experience I ever could have had. It felt like going to grad school in its own sense, because I was 23, 24 when I was doing that job. And it was a great lesson, ultimately, in how to be a professional and how to be a coworker when you're surrounded by these people that you've put on pedestals for years and years and years, and suddenly taking them off and seeing them as collaborators and as people who are, as we all are, we are prone to throwing out ideas and making mistakes and maneuvering around ego and all trying to walk in the same direction to make a thing as great as it can be. Because musical theater is, I can't imagine a more collaborative art form, because you have all these different disciplines that are all trying to come together to make one unified thing. It's sort of a miracle anytime it can happen successfully. It seems impossible on the onset if you just look at the things you have to do and all the people you need to create a structure for. And so to see these paragons who are that were at the height of all their respective fields coming together was an extraordinary learning experience. And how I felt at all equipped to do it, again, was the familial nature of it. Certainly by nature of what the story was about and what Chaz represented every day. Chaz would be in the room every day. Within maybe the first or second week, he had the entire cast over to his home for Sunday dinner with his whole family. Right when I got the job, he gave me a call and he took me to the Bronx. And there are staples of the Bronx that were set pieces in our show, the Burgatti's and Jerome's Pastry Shop. And so we went to Arthur all of those Avenue. Places and he told me stories that had Arthur Avenue. Yes. And there are all these stories that aren't in A Bronx Tale that he would tell me that to help inform who he was and who this character is, because this character is his life story. And to give me that vote of confidence was a great gift and something I'm eternally grateful for. And certainly having people like Nick and Richard Blake teach me what it meant to be a leader, not only on stage, but to create a leadership and a familial nature backstage, was the most important lesson I took from that show. Is how once, if you feel a connection with your collaborators backstage, that will only inform what goes on stage for an audience. And I feel like we had that in spades. And so, on top of, working with Bob and Jerry and Alan Menken and Sergio and Ron Melrose, who I'm doing Tommy with, and the Dodgers. It was really the day-to-day life with Nick and Richard and Bradley Gibson and all of these extraordinary friends and family members that we created every day backstage.
You'll fast forward. I remember 2020, was it February or March, when I went to a preview for a show that was coming to Broadway to Company. And it was just so thrilling to talk to everyone about the show and the excitement. And then, of course, we know what happened in March 2020. And then I wanted to share this with you. So 2021, that's when you started rehearsing again, right? Or, yeah.
Yes.
Well, I was at a rehearsal studio and wafting beyond, you know, so I heard this music singing coming through a door, and it was phone rings, door chimes, in comes Company. And I can't even tell you the joy I felt just hearing it from the other side of the doorway. And I realized, yes, you were rehearsing the show in that building. And it was just, what a feeling to know that Broadway was coming back. The show was coming back. And, I wanted to ask you about that experience working on Company with Patti LuPone, an extraordinary cast, Marianne, even meeting Stephen Sondheim.
It was an embarrassment of riches. Checking off every sort of box. You know, Company was my favorite show growing up. It was the first Sondheim show I had ever seen when I was a child. I saw the John Doyle Actor Musician production
with Raoul.
And I just couldn't believe, with Raoul Esparza discovering the piano. And I just couldn't believe my great fortune that I got to be a part of that production. And again, be a very small part of the history of that show. And to have it be the last show that Steve saw before he passed. To be a part of that history is a great privilege. And again, to work with Marianne particularly was she crafts the safest room and the greatest space for an actor to feel like they can fail, which is ultimately what you have to do to create anything that has some sense of authenticity and truth in what you're doing. And the respect that she extends to all of her fellow collaborators, including her fellow to the actors that she's directing, is something that I hold on to still very dearly, and is a sort of connection that you try to find with every group of collaborators you work with. But you slowly realize that every job you take on will be innately different than what it was before, because all the people will be different, and you can't be a circle peg and try to fit into a square peg, you know, into a square hole. Forgive me. Everything's going to be unique and idiosyncratic and different than what it was before. And that's not a problem. That's the beauty of what we do. So having to retool and relearn essentially how you do what you do, because what you do is only in service of other people, is the joy and fun. But it was to feel like the way Marianne worked and the way I realized I'd liked to work became unified. And she gave me such a safe space and extended such patience to me in order to discover that that's what I actually wanted and needed in a rehearsal space, was a place to feel like anything you tried was welcome, that any going off any instinct was necessary as a means to finding the pathway that will actually lead to what will land best with an audience. Because to try to pigeonhole something as correct before you don't even know what the word correct means or what right means is a disservice to ultimately the final product.
And here you are, we're seeing another 100 people, which most of us know traditionally is sang by a woman. You know, I love the gender changing, you know, elements to that. And is this true that the song was that you sang in the original key, that was created for?
When I discovered from, I got to the great fortune of meeting Pam Myers.
Yeah.
She came to the show a number of times.
We didn't think.
And she showed me the original sheet music that Steve had given her. And the sheet music, the key he had written that in was the key I was singing it in. So clearly he had written it for himself. But that was very surreal to learn. And originally he was asking her to sing that key, but up an octave or two, which is an impossible thing. Just to learn that bit of history was incredible. But she was so generous, and all of the entire company was so generous to each other. We would, because company is a series of vignettes, we would, as we started to piece them together and we would all sit and watch each other, you would just feel like, well, look at the standard that's being set by every cast member. So I got to raise what I'm doing to meet this level. And you're so inspired by what Chris Sieber and Simard are doing in their scene, what Clay Elder is doing in his scene. To share You Could Drive a Person Crazy with Manu and with Clay was such a privilege and so much fun. To see what Patty was doing, how inventive Patty was, how any idea was open and game to her, was so inspiring, and set a standard for how any of us should want to work every day in a rehearsal room. And then to see how Katrina held space for all of us, how Katrina found a unique relationship that felt so personal and idiosyncratic. I keep using that word in this interview. I'm so sorry. For every single person. So we all sat and watched, I thought what we were had was so special and unique, but you have that with every single person. It shows, it's a testament to what kind of an actress, but really what kind of a person Katrina is, to that she can hold space and bring that out of all of us.
She connects. She never leaves the stage.
And that's, yes. And that's ultimately what you have to have is a quality to play Bobby, is that, that sort of intangible quality that makes an audience lean in, even though we know basically nothing about this character.
Yeah.
So little information is given about who she is, what her motives are, what she's going through. It's all done. She as an actress has to fill in all of those gaps. And I was in awe of all of the work she was doing and the space then she held for all of us to be as ridiculous as we want.
And then by being alive, you get it. Even though it's not filled in for you, you say, okay. Now
the universal quality that we all want to feel that way.
So going back to Tommy, what do you hope people take away after seeing the show?
I hope that they, as in any show, but particularly with this, since it's such a sensory overwhelming experience, that they leave with a great emotional catharsis, that they want to go down the wormhole of the history of this music and the history of this person, Pete Townsend, and his life story and what he was trying to communicate through this great metaphor of Tommy, this great anti-hero of Tommy. And ultimately, have conversations with people that you would feel scared to have otherwise, and be a more generous of spirit, empathetic, forgiving person than you were than before you walked into the theater. And I hope that this music and what we're doing within the production with our own performances is in service of that higher calling and of that higher empathy.
Sure it is. Well, Bobby, thank you so much for coming on. It's such a joy and a gift to talk to you.
It's so wonderful to talk to you.
Have a great day and a great performance tonight.
Thank you. Thank
Take
you.
Take care.
Still happens every day when lightning strikes. It's the moment you know.
The theme song was written by Tom McGovern. This episode was edited by Sarah Goodman and produced by Anna Stroud.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the Rise Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RiseTheatre.org. Because only together we rise.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here.
We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.